Welcome to the Exec MBA Podcast. I'm your host, Brett Twitty, and you are listening to a new episode. So on today's episode of the podcast, we return to a frequent topic of conversation here on the podcast, entrepreneurship. And we welcome Executive MBA Format graduate Peter Webb to the podcast to talk more about his business, Grow.DC. Peter is a graduate from our Executive MBA class of 2019, and we recently connected via Zoom to talk more about his background, how he decided to pursue an MBA, and what he has been up to since graduation with his venture, Grow.DC. I think you're going to enjoy this conversation, so without further ado, here is my interview with Peter Webb. Peter, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you very much, Brett. It's great to be here today.
It's great to have you here. Before we get into the meat of everything that we're going to talk about, lots to cover today. Before we get there, just want to check in and see how you and your family are doing at this time. Y'all hanging in there?
You know, it's a challenging time for everybody. We actually had our third kid during the pandemic. So we've been learning how to really manage our time better and make sure that we take care of the kiddos, we take care of our startup, and mainly take care of ourselves and the people around us.
All right. Baby number three. How's everybody doing? Everybody feeling okay? Doing okay?
Everyone's doing great. Mom is doing fantastic. Claire is absolutely incredible. But the boys, she has two. So our youngest is a girl, and she now has two older brothers who love her dearly. Every morning, they go running into her room and try to give her little kisses on the head and play with her as much as possible. So it's been great to see how all three are flourishing together.
Well, great. Great to hear that. Congratulations on the good news and the new addition
Thank
to
you.
Your family. We tell prospective students all the time that certainly while people are in the program, life continues apace. And of course, certainly after the program, things continue to happen. You've got a number of updates to share. Here we're going to talk about your new business venture, Grow.DC. But before we get there, let's learn a little bit more about you. So for our listeners, tell us a little bit more about your background and what you're doing currently.
So before I came to Darden, I was a Army officer for about 10 years, served as a Special Forces commander. So spent a lot of time overseas working with small teams, working with local governments, communities to try to make a positive impact on the area. From moving on from there, my wife and I decided that we wanted a little bit more of a stable life for our children. The idea of moving around a lot was not entirely appealing, and we decided to look at different opportunities in DC. And so when we moved from there, we moved into Alexandria, and I started at Darden, then started at Deloitte.
And, you know, as you were thinking about next steps, when did you realize an MBA could be helpful to you, or what led you to thinking about an MBA?
Well, I spent a long time while I was in the Army thinking about what my life after the Army was going to look like and what the opportunities out there were. I knew that in my background, I had spent ever since I graduated from undergrad, I had been in a leadership position. And so I knew that I wanted to take on a position that still had that level of responsibility. But I felt that I needed to increase my tangible skills and my business acumen before I could move on and confidently portray myself as a leader in a business environment, whatever role that may be. I knew I had the skills in order to work with people and accomplish goals, but I needed to understand what the overall operating context in a business environment was. And so when I was first looking at getting out, an MBA was top of my list of things that I wanted to accomplish. Then my wife and I were able to sort of zone in on specific areas that we wanted to move to. And we were able to organize those based off of which had schools, what kind of schools there were. I was a little bit biased. I went to UVA for undergrad. So looking at Darden was probably top of my list. And so when we found out that there was a program in DC that almost made the decision for us, just being able to go into that job market as a transitioning veteran, as well as have that level of education right next door, it was almost a slam dunk for us. Obviously, we did our due diligence and applied to several other places. But at the end of the day, when my wife and I looked at where we wanted to live and what we wanted to do, and mainly the type of people that we wanted to be around, this Darden and the DC area made sense for us.
Yeah, and that's certainly a familiar story. I think it helps to know UVA from a prior educational experience. We certainly have a number of double Whos in the program, yes, as they are known. Of course, mm-hmm. the Wahoo is yet another way of referring to UVA, UVA student alum, for those of you who are just learning about the University of Virginia. You know, so one of the things that we oftentimes hear from military candidates is they're really not sure where to start the transition process, you know, how to figure out what they can do and where they might go, and does an MBA make sense? You have any advice for people who are kind of in that, you know, thinking about separating or planning to separate and trying to wrap their head around next steps?
Absolutely. I mean, I do that as my outreach back to the Special Forces community. Is any guys who are looking to transition out, I always try to give them my perspective. And I think the biggest piece of advice that I give them is that what you move into does not have to be your forever. Find something that is interesting, something that motivates you to work in the same manner that you did when you're in the service, but keep an open mind to where in maybe 12, 24 months, you'll realize that either this is right for you or you'll find something that is right for you and you can pivot into that. I think being in the military, we're very much locked into that idea of a promotion structure, and there's a singular line towards the command or to promotion, and that I guess rigid structure then goes into our mentality. But when you get out, there is no rigid structure. There's the opportunity to take on whatever challenges that you want to take on, and really the freedom to pursue things that you would have never really thought possible before. I mean, I can tell you for sure that back in 2016, when I was first looking at transitioning out, I never thought that I'd be opening a vertical hydroponic farm inside DC. And so when you look at what I'm doing now versus what I thought was on the table, this wasn't even there. And so I think being able to have that open mind, but approach getting out with an intention to find something that is initially interesting, but being able to look for other opportunities as well.
One of the things that I heard and just what you were talking about is you're having conversations with people who share your background, come from the Special Forces community. It seems like you probably would also encourage people to do a little bit of networking too and have conversations with people who've come before and taken this step.
And that there is, I don't think you can quantify how important networking is and being able to talk to people. I always caution you. I caution people telling others like this is the right way of doing things. I think the only right way of doing things is the way that works for you. I tell people my story, but I always caveat it with this is my story. This is what worked for me. I'm sure that there are pieces of my transition story of me getting my MBA, me going to Deloitte, me going to starting a company that would be interesting to you, but each individual is going to have to cobble that together themselves in order to make sure that they find something that is fulfilling in their own mind.
Yeah, and just having those conversations, hearing about the diversity of paths, you make such a good point about this not having to be a forever decision, right? You know, your first job, the first thing you do, it's just where you start. It's not necessarily right where you have to end. And that's a great point. As you came into Darden, like for all of our students, I think we stress this with prospective students all the time, everyone has learning curves. You know, there's always things that are either new to you in terms of subject matter or just balancing work life and school. For you, what were the biggest adjustments, or what was the biggest adjustment?
So the biggest adjustment for me was definitely managing my time properly. So coming into Darden, had just transitioned out of the military. We had a 9-month-old son. And then I just started at Deloitte as well. So essentially a lot of new things happening in life at the same time. What we knew we had to do was pare down the things that were not necessarily essential. So I looked at my schedule, looked at what I did on an average week, and found those things that were not necessarily giving me energy. What I mean by that is when I completed that, like, was me watching football all Sunday going to be a good use of my time? Did that provide me the energy to go on and do the next thing well. Well, no, it's nice to do. It's nice to have some time to relax. And I think everybody needs to have that. But I was able to look at my schedule, identify the things that I like to do, but not needed to do. But I very much did the inverse. I also identified very much the things that I needed to do in order to keep me going. Like, what are the things in my life that provide me energy, that make it easier to go to, make it easier to stay up till sometimes midnight reading a case? What does my weekend look like? When can I fit time in here to make sure that I accomplish the goals and tasks that I have to accomplish? And so, I mean, I identified those as spending time with my family. So each weekend we always took a trip. We did something. Got the kid out of the house, and that was always invigorating to me to then be able to go back and do some work while my son napped. Or I kept my morning workout routine. That way I was up before the sun, making sure I sweat a little bit, and that just put energy into me to accomplish the day's events. But then seeing where I had time to fit in 20, 30 minutes of reading here, a little bit of time there, but then being able to prepare myself for the longer chunks of doing work after essentially everybody went to bed.
That's a lot of good advice there. I think the thing that I heard you say that resonates with other conversations we've had here on the podcast is trying just to find 20, 30 minutes at times. You know, you're not necessarily working, you know, for hours and hours and hours all the time. Sometimes it's just when you have a little bit of downtime. Just 30 minutes can be helpful in terms of staying on top of things and incrementalizing the work that you have to do.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think with the way Darden is structured in the case methodology, it's working on it for hours at a time may not necessarily yield you all the results that you want. What I noticed is that a lot of times I would have to read a case, do the problems, and then as I let my brain process through what I had ingested, then down the road, maybe it's that afternoon, that evening, or after a good night's sleep, I would actually come away with a broader understanding of what we had studied. And just being able to provide your brain a little bit of time and space to understand what you're processing versus just trying to cram it all into a certain very constrained period of time, that's a difficult thing to accomplish.
Absolutely. And there is some learning pedagogy which suggests that with complex things, you need to give them a little bit of time to incubate and simmer, so to speak. So I wonder if there were any surprising aspects of your Darden experience. When you reflect back on the 21 months in the program, is there anything that was surprising to you as you think about your time as a Darden student?
I think the most surprising pieces I had were when I was traveling overseas. So I was able to do the China trip, and I did the South Africa trip when that was offered. And being able to travel to a different country and then approach it from a lens of very much a business operations management role of, we're not coming here to travel. We're coming to see the sights and understand the culture, but we're coming in and trying to understand what makes business tick here. I was very surprised to see how different, smaller local economies are. Each different country has its own way of conducting business. And this may seem obvious on the outside, it just being able to take a cohort of Darden students and put all those experiences together. Because obviously I came in with my own understanding from the military and being overseas, but being able to see how my classmates reacted and interacted with foreign business was actually one of the most interesting and probably satisfying events that we had. We really got to see the different perspectives and come away with a deeper understanding of what makes business tick outside the U.S. versus inside the U.S.
And that is the goal of the global residencies, right? So that is the thing that we oftentimes will be asked mm-hmm. by prospective students. What's the goal of these experiences? What are you trying to accomplish? And we're really trying to attune students to why business looks the way it does in certain places and how different markets operate? What are the challenges and what are the opportunities created by social, cultural, political, regulatory context? And what kind of questions do you need to be asking? What kinds of things do you need to be thinking about? Well, Peter, you know, in addition to your background and your decision to pursue an MBA and your Darden experience generally, one of the reasons we invited you here on the podcast is to talk about your venture, Grow.DC. We have this sort of ongoing conversation about entrepreneurship and the executive MBA program here on the podcast. And when I heard about your business, it sounded super interesting. It also sounded maybe a little bit different than what you were doing prior to the program and your time at Deloitte. And just wondered, what got you interested in hydroponic agriculture?
So my initial interest in hydroponic farming actually came from my prior 10 years of being overseas. So having explored rural areas on three different continents, I got to see what the more antiquated systems of farming were. But we really got to see how closely tied food security was to economic prosperity. And so by looking at those, it got me interested in, well, if in this country they haven't changed their farming practices in 2,000 years, what is the opposite end of the spectrum? What is the most technologically advanced farming country look like, and why are they able to produce in this way that you don't see in developing nations? So based off of that interest, that when I started Darden, I started essentially building my own hydroponic systems. When I said earlier I needed to find things that gave me energy, building and creating things is something that gives me energy. And so whether it's setting up, I set up a wood shop here at the new house, but when I was living in our other spot in Alexandria before, when I started Darden, I was building a small hydroponic farm just to give my wife the herbs and other things that she wanted to cook, because she has a very diversified palate in terms of things she likes to cook and very exploratory in what she wants, but can't always find like the fresh herbs and other things that she wants to have. So we decided to build a small farm. Obviously it didn't come out very well. So then iteration two came out a little bit better. And then iteration three, I think, was actually successful. But while I was at Darden, it got me thinking of, well, if I could build this and it's very productive inside my house, how could I build a larger enterprise that would have actually affect food security on a larger scale? And so that got me interested in what the current hydroponic food market looks like. And when you look at the hydroponic food market, especially after COVID, I mean, it is growing rapidly. I mean, there are some estimates by 2026, it's going to be a $12.7 billion industry with about a 24% CAGR. And so when you look at it, there's a lot of investment going into it right now. And people see that you can produce a lot with not having to use a ton of space and without having to have your produce travel very far. But when I thought about how I was going to approach the market, I mean, I have a background in small team leadership, essentially, and then couple that with the amazing business acumen and business understanding that I got from Darden. How do I combine these into an organization that is, I'd say, flexible, scalable, and actually provides a community impact? And so what we've developed is a modular hydroponic farm that can be put into a urban area and serve those directly in an urban area. So our whole goal is to bring the harvest all the way down to the point of sale. And so what we've developed is a methodology to where we can grow inside an urban area, but then deliver the produce still live to consumers in a couple of different models, whether that's we go to small markets, to restaurants, or directly to consumers through a mobile farmers market that we have building right now. And so being able to have that modular and flexible farming, we can now operate in the areas that I would say larger farms don't necessarily have the ability to serve. Larger hydroponic farms tend to grow in 100,000 to 150,000 square foot warehouses. They package and then put their produce into a distribution chain from there. But what we're trying to do is bring the distribution chain all the way down to where the consumer is and give them the highest quality produce at a very comparable price. By growing directly where people are, we can actually ensure give them a little bit more food security and resiliency. because we're not going to be dependent on any supply chains moving forward. Everything that we do is housed within the urban area. And then by building out a network of smaller farms, so we have a farm under construction in Norfolk, as well as looking for space here in Alexandria. But as those two farms operate, they can then back each other up. So if you give them give the farms a support network, that actually brings the overall cost of production down and gives them a little bit more resiliency and security moving forward.
I'm going to pause for a second. Hydroponic farming may be familiar to some of our listeners, maybe Yes. Not necessarily all of our listeners. What is hydroponic farming? Say folks at Google here.
So instead of having to Google this, it's hydroponic farming is the practice of growing produce without the use of soil. The specific version of hydroponic farming that we do is vertical aeroponic farming, which means that we take a seed and we put it into a substrate. And so that's just it's something that mimics the composition of soil, but without having to actually put dirt into your system. And that way the seed can germinate over 3 to 5 days. And then that seed and then the substrate are put into a system where it's fed artificial light. And then it has a water nutrient dose misted to the roots. What this allows you to do is essentially put a farm wherever you can have an outlet. And so I actually turned half my basement to my wife's chagrin into a farm as a test model. And so we were able to grow in very customized locations, but also we tend to get a much higher yield per square foot than you'd see in a traditional farm. One of the great advantages of hydroponic farming is that you provide the plant the best possible scenario for its growth. We're not adapting the plant or changing it anyway. We're just providing it the optimal light, the optimal nutrition on the optimal timeline. And that way you actually get a much faster growth rate than you would see in soil, because there's never a cloudy day. There's never too much rain. We also don't have to use any pesticides. We don't have to treat it with anything. We always like to say it's 65 degrees and sunny in our farm, just because that's the way we set it up, and that's the way the plants have been reacting the best. But we are focused on a set of it called, so it's controlled environment agriculture, or CEA, to where you create a small contained environment, and then you set the parameters within that environment. So you set the temperature, you set the humidity, you set the light, you set the water. And then you're able to grow inside that room, or inside that container, inside what we have is a converted department store basement that we're working with. And you're able to see much higher yields out of those small spaces, but then be able to be very flexible in what you grow, when you grow, because we don't have to worry about seasonality. We don't have to worry about freezes. So it's a very exciting time to see what the future of produce is going to look like inside urban areas as urban populations continue to grow.
Certainly a lot of conversation here in the Washington, D.C. area over the past few years about food deserts and access to food. As you note, a lot of these conversations have been accelerated by COVID-19 as supply chains were disrupted. What originally got you interested in this idea of food scarcity and resiliency? Because I think it certainly sounds like that's at the root of your business model.
It absolutely is. And I mean, just being able to clearly see in my past, like how inextricably linked the aspect of food security is for people around the world, and how that ties into their economic prosperity. Because if they're overly concerned about where their children's next meal is going to come from, that will dominate what their next steps are in life. And so if we can, I think there are, we don't have the end all be all solution, but we are part of a larger solution to figure out how do you get food. When I say food, I mean like actually nutrient dense, highly sought after produce into urban areas, into essentially, as you said, into food deserts. We had a wonderful classmate of ours who actually lived in Ward 8, and she talked to me about what the what the situation actually looked like in a food desert. Because, I mean, I would say most people who go to Darden don't live in those areas. And so by getting to see what her actual perspective was living there, it got me thinking of, okay, if I'm going to build a company that's focused on doing hydroponic farming, I don't just want to cater to a specific group of people. I want to have something that has the flexibility to get in and actually create security for people by giving them the opportunity to buy food whenever they want it, but not just buy food at a place that is comparable to where they'll find anywhere else.
And for those of you who are just learning about the Washington, D.C. area, D.C. itself is divided into wards. Take a look at a map as you kind of understand the development of the city. Certainly, this has been an ongoing conversation in light of COVID-19, certainly with the strain placed on grocery stores around the country, including here in the Washington, D.C. area. So, one of the things, Peter, that it struck me as interesting about your story is that, and I wanted to ask about here, is did you imagine that you would launch your own venture when you came to business school? You talked about you sort of took this role at Deloitte, and now you're doing your own thing. Is this something you saw yourself doing?
Initially, when I joined Darden, no, this was not my path. This was not something that I had set out in front of me. After my first year at Darden, I got to sort of sit back and talk with my wife in terms of what our future looked like. What was it about my job that gave me satisfaction? I mean, I had actually had a lot of job satisfaction in the Army, but when we decided to move on from that, I wanted to find something that was essentially equally that helped, as I would say, helped me out in terms of making sure that I had job satisfaction to take care of the family and everything else. I mean, I think being happy in my job was inextricably linked to my happiness overall. While the consulting world was great to go into, I think there was the one aspect that I missed overall was having essentially a tangible output of what I was doing. I very much liked working with my hands. I mean, I've always been a builder. I've done construction on my own homes. I feel like being able to put my hands onto a problem and figure it out was where I would have the best success. And so when we were talking about possibly going down the route of an entrepreneur venture, because we had started talking about this farm, we'd started talking about what it may look like. My wife very much realized, like, well, when you talk about this, you get so much more animated. You get so much more excited about the possibility of it. And I mean, I noticed that she's absolutely right. Like when I talk about the farm, or when I'm actually in the farm, growing plants, taking care of the systems, and out working with some of the customers that we have around DC, it brings me a lot of energy. And so when we talked about that, when I saw that, that's when I essentially shifted my focus, and I wanted to put everything I had at Darden. So for at least my second year of, okay, every class that I take, every conversation that I have within this, how does that then affect me as an entrepreneur? How does that affect my mindset? How does that affect the overarching construct of the company? How does that affect the mission of the company? And so by shifting our focus, I was able to really adapt like what Darden meant at that particular time. Because I think everyone who is at Darden, they're not the same person coming out as they went in. I mean, you're always going to look back and you're going to figure out what you learned by seeing what you did. And the biggest takeaway for me was that I needed to have something that I could do and put my hand on, but also created that overarching impact on the area that I was looking for.
A lot of good points there. I wonder, what does success look like for you with Grow.DC? When you say, you know, it could be 1 year, it could be 3 years, 5 years. Just what does success look like?
I think I get asked this question a lot from potential investors. I mean, the biggest thing to me is being able to show people where their produce comes from. I know we're the way we've designed our model, we're not going to be the largest player within the hydroponic agricultural space, but we've clearly identified a marketplace that is in demand and people want to have it. So it gives a much more personal relationship with people to where their food comes from, because there's, I don't necessarily know how to describe it, but I mean, there are plenty of people who specifically during COVID have gone out and started their own farms. And there's a deep satisfaction of being able to harvest a piece of produce in front of you and then consume it. It gives you a better feeling about your food. It gives you a better feeling as to the security of your food. So I would say success to me would look like having a greater understanding of people, our clients throughout the DC area, appreciating that the farms that we have developed are helping out their community. And so being able to show that by consuming this produce, you're actually helping your community and being able to have a little bit more resiliency, but also just promoting a healthier lifestyle for most people as well.
There's some suggestion, certainly amongst chefs and food writers, that we have lost touch as Americans with where our food comes from and also what it takes to create like a vegetable or a fruit, all the amount of time and effort and care and attention that we would be better served by being much closer to this process. I imagine you have an opinion on that, Peter.
Oh, absolutely. I think my appreciation for the produce I consume, I mean, now I grow everything that I eat in terms of vegetables. My grandfather had a farm growing up, and getting to see how hard it was to work the land, how much time, effort, I mean, actual blood and sweat that went into it. It's a tough thing for farmers who are thousands of miles away to tell that story to people who are then consuming their lettuce or their tomatoes or anything. But if you're able to have that personal connection with a farmer, if you're able to go down and see the farm where it's actually growing, that'll give people a better connection to it. And I mean, I'll challenge anyone to say the piece of produce that you harvest out of our system is probably gonna be some of the best tasting, highly nutritious food that you'll ever taste. I mean, there's a significant difference as to eating something that's been packaged and processed versus something that you're able to harvest right in front of you. And I think as people, I mean, we shifted dramatically over the last, I would say, couple of decades to processing and how can we get more food cheaper onto people's plates. And I think people are starting to realize that, well, maybe this isn't the best thing for my body. And how do I find options that'll increase my productivity by eating things that are better for me and allow me to think and work better?
We had another executive MBA program alum here on the podcast, Hunter Hopcroft, and he talked about what this particular moment potentially meant, you know, everything going on in the world meant for locally sourced fruits, vegetables, produce, livestock, that we are, we've kind of moved in this very centralized, aggregated world when it comes to food processing, and perhaps we're seeing some of the vulnerabilities that that creates. And I can't help but think about that conversation as I hear you talk about this, Peter, this sort of processing that's happened all across the food chain. For us to be closer to our food is ultimately, it creates, as you know, more resiliency.
Absolutely. One of the pieces that we focus on is essentially a disaggregated approach to production. I mean, there isn't a singular site that has to produce everything, package it, and then ship it. How can you identify areas of need and then create a network of farms that will support that area? And this is all, it's linked to my background in the military, to where we very much worked in small teams, but those small teams were able to support each other through different actions. And if we are able to create a network of small farms within, we're focusing on Virginia right now. Where can we put farms into Virginia that will be best supported by the local community, and but also be able to support each other farm and increase that essentially sustainability of each one of those smaller farms. And so, as you said, there's that drive to go local for so many things is only going to increase as you see urban populations continue to drive up. And if we start gaining traction and showing people where this is, what's possible, that's where you'll really start seeing people change their mentality of, well, if I could get produce from the supermarket, that's fantastic, and I'm going to keep doing that. But maybe there is a section of the population that does want to really hone in on where their food comes from, because it'll give them that peace of mind and that security and that understanding of what I'm eating is really going to give me the best possible output.
So how did you identify Norfolk as a second potential market for your company?
We had just been talking with other people. Essentially, I kept a very open mind in terms of different opportunities. And then when we got introduced to the folks down there, we thought that would be just a fantastic place to expand to and really build out a larger modeled farm. And Norfolk has its issues just like DC has its issues. I mean, they have food deserts. I mean, I think any urban area, what we're building does not have to be just a DC problem. I mean, this is a problem that you can find in just about any urban area. But by applying our modular farm solution, we believe that we can actually affect change regardless of the area.
There's also an argument that in rural areas and outside of cities, you also run into these same issues. Sometimes you're closer to farmland and sometimes you're not. So seems like there's a lot of potential here. What's next for grow.dc? Obviously, it sounds like you got some things underway in Norfolk. What are you working on next?
So we are building one of our larger sites in Norfolk. We looking to bring on a few team members down there, some farmers and some site managers. But as of right now, we are focused on what our clients want. And so we have a couple of clients here in the DC area, and making sure that what we're growing and how we're providing produce to people is really what the market wants. And is that, are we growing it in a manner that is sustainable as well as meets what we believe the future needs of that area are going to be. Also trying to just identify how flexible can we get with our live harvest produce. My idea is that wherever a customer is, we should be able to get them a live head of produce. And whether that's through a delivery model, our mobile farmers market, or getting shops that are in food deserts to host some smaller farms, I think there's a good opportunity to do as much market research as possible before any kind of significant scaling comes into effect.
So I'm wondering what you're growing right now in some of these farms that you have up and running.
So right now we've been growing a lot of leafy greens. So when I say leafy greens, I mean we grow bib lettuce, red oak, spinach, arugula, some kale, some chard, some very good, highly nutritionally dense items. Other ones, bok choy, have been very popular. I started a essentially one garden of herbs, so a couple different kinds of basil, like Genovese basil, Thai basil. But we're also experimenting a little bit more with vine crops and how can you get a vine crop to be in a more modular farm setup. And there's some fantastic companies out there that are growing tons of tomatoes underneath the greenhouse systems. But I set up a small farm in my house that grows tomatoes year round. I've had one tomato plant that probably kicks out 3 or 4 pounds of tomatoes every week for the last year and a half. And so it's been great just being able to have tomatoes on demand, and then being able to see what the difference in flavor is from the tomato that comes off the vine versus the one we get at the store has been incredible. So we also grow a wide variety of microgreens. Microgreens are a great product in my mind that people don't really know much about, but essentially it's that it's that first, that second phase of growth after you get from the sprout phase into the microgreen phase is where a plant is just coming up. And it is a very nutrient dense stage of growth for that plant. So you can see an entire mat. We have a fantastic supplier who gives us these bamboo mats. And instead of having to grow in soil or anything that requires a lot of maintenance, we grow in like a sustainable bamboo mat that you can then grow for 14 days and get a very delicious, nutrient-dense product out of it. And so we're able to take those bamboo mats and deliver them live microgreens to customers sort of around DC.
Well, that's incredible. As you were describing the tomato plant, I have these memories from my childhood. My grandfather would have tomatoes, but really in the summer, right? Because that's a common time when the tomato plant really seems to thrive. And I was thinking about what you were saying about basically having year-round tomatoes from this indoor environment. And in light of climate change and just what's going on with our overall ecosystems, that they're currently changing and being disrupted as well. Seems like there's a lot of potential as well, given some of the environmental factors here.
I think there's a lot of environmental factors that go into our method of production. I mean, one of the most dramatic ones you'll see is water use. I mean, I don't think, I know Peter DeBeer has had a fantastic paper and understanding on global water use. But one of the things that we notice is that through our growing methodology, we use up to about 95% less water than you'll see in traditional farming, because everything we do is on a recirculated water system. So as our plants are watered, then that water is recaptured, cleaned, put back into a reservoir, and then reused with a proper nutrient dose for that specific plant. So just by being able to recycle, recap water, you're seeing a much greater improvement of efficiency there. Also, because we do vertical farming, we stack up to about 5 or 6 levels high. And so when you come into a room, it's not just a single square foot. A single square foot multiplied by 6 or 7. I mean, there are some amazing companies up in New York that are, I mean, they get up to about 26 levels high. I mean, they have some amazing production capabilities. But also looking at the distance to which our produce travels. I mean, everything that I sell right now is usually either in the same zip code or a zip code adjacent to where the farm is. And that way you can look at the trucking miles, the aircraft miles, anything that your produce does not have to travel is essentially in my mind a win for the environment as well. I just think that there's a lot of good opportunity to affect climate change by changing the way we produce overall.
I think there are a lot of people who would agree with you that agriculture has drawn a lot of attention recently as part of this conversation. So one last question for you here. It's been fascinating learning about your business, and thanks for answering all of my questions about Grow.DC and sharing your background. I wonder, what's your pitch as to why Darden? When you talk with prospective students, why this particular program?
I give that. I answer that question a lot to the folks that I talk to getting out of the Army. And I think the number one thing for Darden that I always look back on is the people. I think the case methodology that is taught really helps us communicate very well when you're in small teams, you're able to work very well with your team, but also as a class overall, you get to hear these different opinions and a very good diverse level of thought across Darden. And so what I noticed from I think 90% of my close friends now are from Darden, and I see them all the time, and they wouldn't have been the same people same friends that I had in the military. I mean, everyone now has a different background. Everyone has a different way of thinking, a different way of approaching the problem. And so when I talk to them, say hopefully in a post-COVID environment, we'll be able to go out and have a meetup again one day. But when we talk to them about sort of what I'm doing and what they're doing, we're able to provide just such interesting perspectives on it. And so that's what I always tell people is Darden sets up a learning environment where you're going to have the best possible interaction with your peers, and then really come away with really great relationships down the road. Because I think the Darden, the 2 years of education, I mean, it's a wonderful 2 years. You learn so much. But the real benefit of Darden is after you graduate, and then you have this cohort of friends, but you also have this network of other Darden alumni who will come to your aid or essentially answer any questions that you have because you have that shared background. And so, yeah, for me, Darden's all about the people that I went to school with, but also the people that are out there now and the alumni that you're able to interact with.
Peter, I want to thank you for your time today. It's been great talking with you. Great to catch up. I would have loved to do this in person, but that's just not where we are right now. But congratulations on your business. When I saw a post about it on LinkedIn, I was like, we got to get Peter on the podcast. We got to talk about what he's up to. And it sounds like things are going well. So good luck, and I hope you and your family stay safe. And thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Brett. It's been great chatting with you, and I really hope to see you in person soon.
And that was my interview with Peter Webb, a graduate from our Executive MBA class of 2019. As always, if you have any comments, suggestions, requests, anything you'd like for us to cover here on the podcast, we're all ears. We can be reached at exec, that's E-X-E-C, MBA at darden.virginia.edu. Until next time, stay safe, be well, and thanks for listening.